Welcome to Eucharist Podcast, where we're exploring what it looks like for a community of disciples to live all of life in reference to Christ. Welcome back to the Eucharist Podcast. This week, we are continuing our discussion of the patient ferment of the early church, looking at chapter 6. So let's look at what's happening in this chapter. So in this chapter, it shows how early Christians were formed through the catechumenate and baptism. So Ryan, do you have a few thoughts on that?
Yeah, just to begin with, he is continuing his thesis that the distinctive life of the church was what was made the church so attractive. It wasn't that worship was what people were attracted to, or the message, on at least on its face, was the thing they were attracted to. They were attracted to the lives of Christians. And then he begins the chapter by talking about how, quoting Tertullian, who wrote around the year 200, that he said, Christians are made, not born. In other words, the church is always one generation away from extinction. Like, they're always, just because you grew up in a Christian family does not mean that you are a Christian. You have to be formed as a Christian. Now, there's some advantages, obviously, because you've already experienced the habitus, etc. But so, speaking of habitus, he really leans into that. And he says, okay, so there is this distinctive habitus, this is distinctive set of practices and ways of living and ways of thinking that the early church had. How were those formed? Well, he says they were formed in catechesis, and they were renewed in worship. So this chapter, he's really focusing on catechesis, and he explores that fairly in depth, going back to how did this begin in the early church. Now, some of our listeners may not know what catechesis or catechumenate is. Why don't you give us a little description of that, Joshua?
Yeah, so the catechumenate was this ancient practice of the church of forming disciples over a course of several years, up to 3 years at times. And it would include coming in under a sponsor. So you would enter into the catechumenate, and there'd actually be a formal kind of entrance into the catechumenate. You'd be often brought forward before the church and prayed over, sometimes anointed with oil, I think. Mm. And you would enter into this process of formation.
So it's like a formal on-ramp.
Yeah, it'd be a formal on-ramp where you are entering into the community, mm-hmm. but you're not yet a full communicant. Yeah.
Yeah,
so and so it's this liminal space of formation where you're no longer outside the church, but you're not yet integrated into the church in all its fullness. And so the interesting thing is, if you had entered into the catechumenate and you died, you were still given a Christian burial. Mm-hmm. But you would not be able, you would not yet have been baptized, and so you would not be able to partake in the Eucharist. And in fact, in some of the early liturgies, you'd only be able to participate in the first half of the service, the liturgy of the word, and then you would leave before the liturgy of the upper room or communion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some other descriptions sometimes used to describe the catechumenate. Some of the early church people referred to it as almost a kind of boot camp, thinking in terms of military. You have to go through a boot camp to be prepared, formed, initiated into military service. And in a similar way, you needed a boot camp, in a sense, to prepare yourself to really be living as a Christian. Another description, John Chrysostom, one of the great preachers in the early church, referred to the catechumenate as a wrestling school, which I think is such a great term. So you had to learn how to wrestle. You had to learn how to get your craft in shape.
I really like that analogy, or that imagery of a boot camp, because I have a lot of friends who have gone through boot camp in the military. And the ironic thing about boot camp is you're doing all these things. You're learning, terms, and you're learning how to do things that you'll be doing in the military.
And you're taking on an identity.
But the big thing is actually identity formation. To those who are going to go into specialties, the thing that they learn in boot camp is actually not that useful in the specifics. It's more the whole. The sum of the whole is greater than its parts. Mm. And so boot camp, really, all these things, all the running, all the terminology, all the different activities and disciplines you learn, is really just about infusing into you the culture of military life.
Yeah.
It's not so much about whether you can put your rifle together or not. You're going to learn that later on better.
Right.
But it's about forming this kind of communitas, this kind of become knowing what it is to be a Marine. They have all these traditions, and it's very formative. So by the time you get out of boot camp, you have this shared experience that has been an incubator and has kind of infused you with this new identity that then continues to be formed in, you know, in your career and in your line of service.
Yeah.
But it was this kind of break with the civilian world, entering into a new life and infusing that culture and values that are then later developed.
Boot camp is also a good, maybe a good metaphor for this too, because in boot camp, there's also a sense in which you are having your individuality stripped away from you. Your previous identity is not that important.
That's why they shave heads.
Exactly.
Right?
You shave your hair off. You take a number. You do thing, no matter where you came from, whether it's a rich family or a poor family or whatever ethnicity you are, you're doing the same thing with these people. And the message is loud and clear, and that is that the group matters, and that you're submitting yourself to a kind of tradition, to a kind of living community that is not just, you know, your preferences. And there's an authority that you're living under. It's also an establishment of authority. So it's really clear when you join the military that it's not merely like a supplemental thing to the life you already were living. Like, something very transformational is happening to your life. You're reforming your identity. And that's, at even a deeper level, that's what's happening in Christian formation, in preparation to become a Christian. It's not merely like, oh, I have my life. Oh, it'd be nice to take a little supplement, you know, of some kind to add into what I'm already doing, that Jesus is a good supplement to my life. No, actually, it's not like that. It's utter stripping down and rebuilding a whole new identity. One of these, a guy named Aidan Cavanaugh that I read from time to time, says that catechesis helps the convert reassemble his or her personality and life around the new center of gravity, which is God revealed in Christ Jesus.
So all of life in reference to Christ.
All of life in reference to Christ. There it is. That's our motto, our tagline at Eucharist Church.
Yeah, well, how did they do it? In this chapter, he lays out like the four stages of Christian formation.
Well,
right?
let's back up for a second. So first of all, he follows the story of how this developed. And in the earliest stories of the church, some people will know from reading the book of Acts that there's no description really of much of catechesis or a catechumenate. By the way, catechesis just means teaching, and the catechumenate is like the school of teaching, if you want to think of it that way. It's like the process, right? So, but there's no description of that in the earliest pages of the New Testament. I think some people have this question. They're like, well, why do you need a catechumenate? You remember the Ethiopian riding in the chariot? He was baptized right on the spot. Like, what's the deal?
Yeah.
And he addresses that some in here.
Or the centurion.
Or the centurion, right, yeah.
Yeah.
And he addresses that in here, and he says, essentially, Judaism was the catechumenate, preparing people to live as Christians. They already were immersed in a story. They understood something about God, about holiness, about purity, about, following the Ten Commandments, things like that. So much of their life was already in order. So taking on the knowledge that Jesus was the Messiah of the Jewish people and the Messiah really of the whole world was like the next stage in that. It wasn't like a whole different story.
Yeah.
Whereas down the road, once the church was less of a distinctively Jewish sect, and pagans and barbarians and, you know, all different kinds of Greco-Roman people and all other kinds of people around the world where it was spreading were joining, they were not coming in from a Jewish background. So they had to be put through.
So they didn't have that shared cognitive environment or shared culture, shared rhythm.
Exactly.
That much of the first wave of the early church being Jews had.
Yeah.
So they understood feasts and fasts and God as holy and God as one.
Yes.
They just kind of had to recognize the Messiah and how Jesus fulfilled what they already had.
Yeah.
But when you had someone that came worshiping Zeus or Thor or Odin, that there's not much of a shared cognitive environment for them to draw on. You have to kind of start over.
Yeah, there's a reformation totally there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So over time, the church began to develop sort of informally initially, and then it took on more and more formality. By about the third century, you have a pretty formed notion of some stages that people would move through in previous to, you know, preceding baptism.
Mm-hmm.
So the first stage is what he calls evangelism. It's really pre-catechumenate. Someone's not formally in the they're not enrolled in the catechumenate. They're not part of the wrestling school, so to speak. You know, this is when Christians are out and about doing business, when they're building relationships with their neighbors, getting to know them, sharing, doing life together. There is an opportunity to give witness to the hope that Christians have, and to give as First Peter says, to give a reason for the hope that we have.
So if we were to liken this to dating, this would be kind of the group hang stage, right? Where you all go bowling, yeah, or go see movies. You're not really coupled together.
You look across
together.
The room and you see that cute girl.
And you're like, I want to spend more time with them.
Yeah.
But as a group, you're kind of just getting to know each other. Something's attracting you to them, but it's kind of still informal.
Yeah. And this stage, if you want to call it a stage, could go on indefinitely, years, months, whatever. It also could be rather short. You know, when someone, in a sense, someone enrolls in the catechumenate once they have a desire to follow Jesus. They want to know something about what it means to live this Christian life. So if you want to think of coming to faith, where does that happen? Well, it happens throughout all the stages, but there is a kind of coming to faith moment where someone goes, I really want to follow Jesus.
There's almost like a captivation. Yeah. Like you're captivated by the faith, or you're captivated by Christ somehow.
Yeah.
So you don't fully know who he is and what this implies, but there's just kind of this come follow me, and you're like, I think I'm going to take that step.
And you could even think of like to go back to Jesus, Jesus calls people like Levi the tax collector, or Peter and John and Andrew, or whatever else, and he invites them to come follow. Then they have like a 3-year period where they get to understand what that really means. Are they Christians? Yeah, that's not really a term for them then, but are they following Jesus? Yes. But they haven't fully been initiated into the full meaning of that yet. It really doesn't happen until after Jesus' death and resurrection.
Yeah. So there's this captivation, and then it moves into cultivation. So you have this desire growing in you. Now it's formalized. So it's like you actually, to go back to the dating analogy, you're like, okay, I think we can kind of date. You have a define the relationship type of moment.
You begin courting.
Right?
At that point.
Yeah, right?
It's traditional language. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and at that stage, what happens in the traditional structure is that to move from stage one to stage two, stage one being sort of pre-catechumenate, stage two being the catechumenate formal, you have to have a sponsor. Some people might be familiar with that language from AA, where you have a sponsor who is responsible for caring for you. They actually stole that straight from this stuff here. So finding somebody, by the way, this is when you hear of somebody having a godchild, same idea. It's an outside of the family person who's a sponsor of that person. So having a sponsor is someone who will vouch for you, someone who will watch over you, someone who will mentor you. These are all parts of it. Then the catechumenate
begins. They serve as your point person to the community. Like they're kind of your bridge, your Barnabas of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Then the actual catechumenate involves involves a lot of things. Really involves the reformation of your center of gravity, your personality, your habits, your inclinations, your desires. It also involves learning the Christian faith, learning doctrine, learning what does it mean? Who is God? What story are we part of? Learning the scriptures. So a big part of this is hearing the word of God. If you want to generalize what's happening, it's hearing the word of God. Then the catechumenate takes on a more distinctive focus in a third period, which is called baptismal preparation.
So this is like in the courtship when you're like, yep, we're going to get married. Let's start planning the wedding.
Engagement.
It's engagement.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So from sort of like the group hangout to like the courting to like engagement now. Now we're like, we're going to go for this. It's going to happen. Then there's a ramp up period to like really understand that.
The premarital counseling of sorts. Like, hey, do you know what you're getting into? You know, what following Christ is going to cost you. You know, your job is making idols. You can't do that anymore. Or, you know, your job exploits others. You need to stop that.
Yeah.
You know, and some people actually break off engagement, right? It talks about that. Like they just couldn't cut it. They counted the cost and realized they weren't willing to pay.
Yeah. 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 So at this point, this often, There's a date sort of set usually in the calendar of the year. I think there's traditionally like, what, 4 Sundays that are for baptism set aside?
Something like that,
yeah. But most of the baptisms happened around the Great Easter Vigil, which is mm-hmm. the Saturday night before Easter. And we'll do that actually in our church this year as well, too. There's a really beautiful service that begins outside in the world with a bonfire, and then the light, there's a Paschal candle lit, and you bring it inside, and you tell the whole story of the scriptures, and then there's a renewal of baptismal vows for those who are already baptized, and for those who are becoming baptized, that's the chance where there's a special baptismal liturgy that begins, that happens there, and then the baptism itself is the culmination.
Which I love. One of the many things I love about the historic baptismal services and how we do it in the Anglican Church is how encouraged I am. Not only do you see someone coming to faith, but how it's such a renewal of your own vows. It's kind of almost mm-hmm. like going to a friend's wedding with your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see them getting married and you know it's about them, but it kind of reminds you of when you were married.
Yeah.
And it kind of has this awakening and renewal of your own love for your spouse going, oh, I remember that. And it kind mm-hmm. of brings you back to that place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so wonderful.
Yeah. One of the things that people are a little bit surprised to learn that happens in this stage is historically, there was teaching, there was baptismal preparation, but there were repeated exorcisms, which may sound a little funny, like we think of like the Exorcist movie or something like that, really dramatic. But what the early church was convicted about was that there was the kingdom of darkness, and which was the world apart from Christ, and there's the kingdom of light. And this transition through the catechumenate is a movement from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. And that means there has to be a renunciation of the power of evil, a power of the kingdom of darkness. And the early church recognized that sometimes that power would hide itself and latch onto aspects of life. And so there's repeated opportunities for exorcism, even into the baptismal liturgy itself, where there's 3 renunciations and then there's 3 new confessions of faith as part of the symbol there. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, just clarifying that that's part of the transition then.
And I know in some of the early baptismal liturgies, you actually kind of, during those renunciations, you even spit. You spit at the devil. Because also in some cultures.
You spit to the west or something like that, is that right?
You spit to the west or you blow. Because in some ancient cultures, blowing was a form of like casting out spirits as well. So you kind of spit or blow and you say, no, I say no to this. And I turn and say yes to that.
Yeah.
But it's such a great pivotal point that you can look back on and be like, no, I've renounced this.
Yeah.
I've accepted this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's embodied. It's not just intellectual. It's not just an mm-hmm. idea somewhere.
Yeah. And it's something that comes at a culmination of months and years of leading up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's kind of like with we're in Advent right now, coming up to Easter, and how in your sermon last week you talked about preparation. Like, we're so filled with we snack all the time that mm-hmm. when we come to the feast of Christmas, we're already full and we can't even take another bite. I think there's something about this process that builds this longing and this hunger so that when they come to baptism, it's something that they are hungry for and yearning with every part of their being.
Yeah.
And I know in some early baptismal liturgies, not only after that would you go and take communion for the first time, but they'd also give you some milk and honey.
That's right.
To represent you're now in the promised land.
Yeah.
Like you've arrived, you're out of the desert. And I think that's just... Man.
And with that also, people are involved in what was called the exchange of the kiss of peace as well for mm-hmm. the first time. And the kiss of peace was a sense that you belong in this family. You're now part of the household when you're initiated, which is such beautiful imagery again. So you can imagine that because there's this long run-up to this long on-ramp, that baptism really meant something to people. It wasn't just a hoop you jump through. And the preparation before that meant that people really knew what they were doing when they were coming in from the outside. Now, there's another story that isn't told really in this chapter much, which is the story of those who grew up in the church. And they might have been baptized as infants, which is typically what was done historically. There's another kind of catechumenate that overlaps.
Yeah.
That's like maybe you would say a catechumenate from the font, from the baptismal font. Like it happens from the childhood onward. And like in our Anglican tradition, it's formally completed with confirmation then. So mm-hmm. people are, when they're kind of age and they begin, they learn, they study, then there's a sealing of their baptism with confirmation that happens. So a similar process has to happen with every single person who becomes a Christian, whether they grew up in the church or they came from the outside. Now, obviously, coming from the outside, there's a different kind of on-ramp you need to just to get a sense of the language, what's going on, what's the story we're a part of, who is this Jesus, what does it mean? But then from within the church, too, there has to be a sense that a person is fully taking on this faith for themselves. And it's yeah. not just a family faith, but it's their faith.
I think that's one of the things that really changed when I had kids, was thinking of how I was going to be their father and how I was going to lead them in the faith. Hmm. And this kind of revivalist kind of model didn't really work because I wasn't comfortable raising my kids outside the covenant,
right?
Or treating them as outsiders.
Yeah.
And the thing is, God was working in their hearts in ways that it was impossible for me to interact with them yeah. as outsiders, because they were having these experiences and this real genuine love for Jesus that baffled me yeah. and completely made me kind of rethink like how I interacted and how I was going to actually raise mm-hmm. them in the faith. Because really, when you're raised in the faith and you're formed as a Christian, it really takes then a conscious choice to depart from that. Like, you yeah. can't just raise kids neutrally. I think that's a fallacy. You have to
I hear that all the time. Yeah. I hear people trying to say like it's not fair to impose my religious views on my children, so I'm going to raise them neutrally, you know, like I'll expose them to all these faiths. That's complete BS.
No, because it's not neutral. That's actually a specific...
It is a form of... It's like a secular frame that you're giving them already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, really, you're basically raising them as Christians and praying and hoping that they continue in this formation. And if they don't, then they're not just unbelievers. They're in apostasy, which is actually yeah. raises the stakes even more.
Right.
But it's not like, oh, I'm going to kind of hope and hope that one day they'll choose to come back. It's like, no. Raise them in the family
yeah.
and pray that they stay in the family, because it is a distinct difference when they walk away from the faith yeah. or having growing up without anything and then never coming to it.
Yeah. And we'll get to this next time when we talk, but the role of the Eucharist in relationship to baptism, and maybe we'll talk about that in a moment for a little bit as well, but when you are baptized, the constant renewal of your baptismal commitment is the taking of Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like even if you were baptized early on and you don't remember it because it was an infant, that it doesn't mean anything. No, it does. You renew it every time you take the Eucharist as well. So I think there's an important piece of that for those who maybe were baptized but don't remember and they grew up in the church, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to one more thing here about the catechumenate, there's a fourth stage to the catechumenate, which is after baptism, and it's called mystagogy, which is a word that we don't really use, but it's basically just refers to ongoing instruction and formation for people after baptism. So all of us who are at a church right now, who are learning more about what it means to follow Christ, who are being formed more deeply, we're in a kind of mystagogy. But to actually formalize and say, no, you need to keep on learning, and here's what you need to keep working on, is what the catechumenate was trying to do, is to say, this is an ongoing thing. You don't end your process of learning to be formed like Christ.
Mm-hmm. And so here's the elephant in the room is, this sounds amazing. This was before Christianization and Constantine, and this is before, you know, this is not 21st century America,
yeah.
where there's different denominations and many people have already been baptized without any idea of what a catechumenate is.
Yeah.
How do we get back to this rich formate, like how do we form disciples nowadays?
Yeah.
Drawing from this, but knowing that it almost has to be a mystagogical catechumenate, because many of the people in our congregation are baptized yet have never been catechized or
yeah. Yeah. I think that's a challenge. We're inheriting the legacy of Christendom, which Christendom sort of assumed that the entire culture was Christian, and thus that just by definition, if you were in Western Europe or you were in America, you were Christian already. But that has left us deeply impoverished as a church, because we haven't been shaped and formed to live distinctively Christian lives. And so we have a kind of bastardized form of faith that we've normalized. And so the church is going to pay a price for this. We see this all the time. There's a lot of hypocrisy. There's a lot of embarrassment about stuff that goes under the name of Christian. And in a city like San Francisco, I think sometimes, I don't know if you feel this way, Joshua, but I feel embarrassed sometimes to be called a Christian when it's associated with some of the stuff that is clearly not Jesus-like, clearly not deeply traditional Christianity anyway.
It has a different meaning than it did back then for them.
Yeah. So we live, I say this culturally, all to say that we don't.
A different cultural meaning.
Yeah. I say this to say that we don't live in the same setting they did. They lived in a pre-Christian setting. They didn't have the baggage of coming out of a Christendom, kind of the collapse of Christendom. So as you said, maybe we live in a setting where a lot of our work is mystagogical, where we have to continue to take people who have already been baptized and help them understand that they still need to learn the basics of what it means to be a Christian. And I don't just say that for other people. That's been a process I've been in. I know you've been doing this as well, too. Like, we're not claiming to be experts in this. We just see there's a yawning gap between what it means to live as a Christian and what we see Christians at the best historically doing and what we're doing today. Mm-hmm. And how that works. So I think we need to come to this with a lot of humility.
And we almost have to kind of reverse engineer some stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like kind of, because I know, I mean, college, seminary, you know, mm-hmm. ministry, but a lot of the basics of forming your life around prayer.
Yes.
I never got that. I mean, I grew up with this, you need to read your Bible and have a quiet time, but nobody ever really taught me how to do a quiet time. And that was kind of privatized, and it was your own individual thing. And it wasn't about entering into a community and a life of a congregation that is reading scripture together, which is praying. And so I think maybe having a vision of where we're going is helpful.
Yeah.
And then the humility to go back and say, you know what, we need to kind of shore up our formation.
Yeah, I think also just there's a sense that many people look at following Jesus or Christianity as, again, supplemental to the life they already have. That the way we think as Americans, for instance, is sufficient pretty much already. You just need to add a little Jesus to the mix, and then you have a good life. And I think that the truly thinking Christianly, truly acting and living Christianly, dismantles certain aspects of our cultural assumptions that are really painful, actually. So we have to be, like the boot camp metaphor, we need to have some things stripped away from us, some of our individual autonomy, some of the bad habits that our culture has given us, whether in thinking or behavior, before we can actually begin to take on a truly distinctively Christian lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's some of the challenge. You know, backing up to your question, like, how do we do this? We have been thinking about this now for over a year. And one of the difficulties is, as we've said on this podcast before, people inhabit their careers, and there's just so little time that people are willing to even devote to this. But we still feel like we need to figure out an actual, realistic, formal on-ramp into Christian faith. And one of the ways to talk about this would be to talk about, or to make sense of it would be to use a metaphor. I'm borrowing this metaphor from some other friends in the Anglican Church North America that are working on this as well too. If you think of the church as a household, it's like the household of God. We need to have a big front porch. We don't in our city here. We don't really have front porches very much. We live in apartments and tiny little
a big community
flats.
Room.
Yeah,
no,
so,
but quite, you know, it's a porch,
but in traditional neighborhoods, I think everybody knows that, you know, there's like a front porch. And that came out towards the street, and it was recognized that that was kind of a liminal zone where it was meant to greet people and offer them hospitality, to have conversation with neighbors, where it wasn't so intimate. It wasn't like you were inside the house or in, you know, or part of the family or something. That has been lost, by the way, just architecturally, because McMansions made garages the front face of the street, which is interesting.
It's all about the backyard.
Yeah, it's all about the backyard, right? But anyway, and again, in historical communities, there was a front porch, front yard, and people were welcomed there from the street. And in a sense, our church needs to develop a big front porch where people can interact with us, can know what's going on, can realize it's hospitality on our terms, but it's more of a liminal place of...
But it's distinctly a porch and not a living room or something.
Exactly. Right? So then to take the metaphor to the next step, what the catechumenate is a kind of like a moving walkway, if you want to say it that way, towards the front door of the house. And if you think of it's like taking you inside. It's showing you what it's going to look like inside. And then when we welcome people into our home, our household, we welcome them sometimes as guests, right? They sit at our table, but they know they don't belong there. They're not part of the household yet. And that's some of the community life that we do. We call that like second table activities.
Yeah. So it's kind of like you need an usher or a guest or a welcomer who comes from the porch and takes someone by the hand and leads them into the house, says, here, let's sit down, let's share a meal. Okay, now it's time to go. Kind of that go-between person, that advocate or mediator to the community.
And we need to all be those people to others, But then there's a sense in which it would be weird if we had guests into our house and we invited them into the bedroom.
Yeah.
That's just like, that's creepy. It's inappropriate. Like we all kind of feel that sense. Like the living room, maybe the dining room table is an appropriate place to have a guest. They're there for a bit and then they leave. But you don't bring someone into your bedroom. And if you want to think about, take the metaphor and apply it to the church, the bedroom is really what happens at Eucharist, in the Lord's Supper, the communion. Mm-hmm. That's the most intimate act of the church. It's so a renewal of
our so baptism is like the wedding.
Baptism is like the wedding. The wedding ceremony. It establishes the household, right? You're part of the,
And now, the Eucharist is like the bedroom. And not to be crude, but this is, I mean, the church fathers and many people use this kind of analogy, this intimacy. It's meant to be the closest exchange and intimacy between us and God.
And what's been confusing is I think for many, many churches, they've tried to make the bedroom the front door. Say, come on in, come into our worship service, experience the most intimate act with us. And then they've cheapened that, and it doesn't mean anything. And it's become an individualized sort of consumer thing. And it's lost the household sense. So the boundaries have been lost, the meaning has been lost. So what this whole process is, if you take it all back to the beginning, is saying, how do we meet people on the street, be Christians out there, welcome them onto the porch, have a large, big porch, a big liminal space for people to kind of journey, then create ways for them to come appropriately in as
our guests.
Take them
by the hand and usher them in.
And then if they really want to be part of this household, initiate them into the family, which is what baptism is. Being born again, you're being born into a new family, or being adopted. Those are all metaphors from the scripture. You're adopted into the household of God. And then we feed from the table of the Lord. And the bedroom becoming sort of the metaphor, the intimate act that is at the heart of the family there. So that's kind of an extended metaphor that it might give people a little bit of the dimensions that we're talking about.
I think that's great. And that's something that you, the listeners, can be praying for us as we try to figure out how to do this in a city that is at the same time one of the most post-Christian cities in America and simultaneously one of the most de-churched cities in America.
Yeah, it's got both going on.
And even have with immigrants and different refugees, you have pre-church. So you have these diverse set of people and stages, and how can we serve and do this process for all of them in their different contexts? And that's kind of what we've been seeking the Lord about.
Yeah, we're still trying to sort out exactly how do we get the front door in the right place. It's not really the bedroom, but we also need to build that catechumenate on-ramp, that sort of walkway. So again, be in prayer for us about that. And we'll this next year, 2017, we're going to be doing a lot of work towards that.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in to our discussion of the chapter 6 of the Patient Ferment of the Early Church. Stay tuned for next week when we get into chapter 7.